Thank you. As I say, we're looking at chapter two, and chapter two is a discussion of the impact of what he said in chapter one. And it breaks down into three sections, as I see it. The first, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, are the implications for paying attention to what he expects from men. That's what Jesus expects from men. And then, once you've seen that, we'll go on to discuss two ways that your Hebrew mom is going to try to avoid this implication, and she's going to make perhaps two arguments. First is that Jesus is not superior to the angels because he became a man. And the second argument that she would make is that Jesus is not superior to the angels because he suffered all the way up to the point of death. And the writer is going to give us the way to understand why those two arguments are not true. So let's read the beginning. Chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, and this is from the American Standard Translation, by the way. Therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things which we have heard, lest haply we drift away from them. For if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which, having at the first been spoken through the Lord, was confirmed to us by them that heard? God also bearing witness with them, both by signs and wonders, and by manifold powers, and by gifts according to the by gifts of the Holy Spirit, according to his own will. Now, it's important to understand that chapter 2 comes as a result of chapter 1. That's why he starts chapter 2 by saying, therefore. The implications that we're going to talk about tonight, and this one major implication, follows or flows from chapter 1. The implication is worded in the form of a conditional statement. That's a logic description. We typically think of it as an if-then statement. So let's talk about what these if-then statements are like, and talk a little bit about the rules that apply when we try to analyze an if-then statement. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to analyze Paul's argument, or Paul is the writer. We're going to analyze the writer's argument, and we're going to use the rules that you have to use when you look at this kind of statement. Now, a conditional statement is a statement that can be written in the form if P, then Q. That's why we call it an if-then statement, where P and Q are sentences. So we're going to have to go back, and we're going to have to kind of reorder some of the things that the apostle says, because we want them to be sentences. For this conditional statement, P is the hypothesis and Q is the conclusion. Intuitively then, if P then Q means that Q, the conclusion, must be true whenever the if statement is true, whenever the hypothesis or the P statement is true. Now, as you look at the argument, Paul makes two conditional statements here. If P then Q means that Q must be true whenever P is true. The conditional statement that he makes first, and part of this is implied, the if part of it, the hypothesis, the P, is this statement, the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward. That's just verse 2. The Q part of this conditional statement, number 1, is you must give heed to what is said. Now, this is implied. It's not stated in the text, but it's implied. And the reason that you can imply this is because every Jew is going to imply this. And remember, we're writing to Jews and we're giving them a reason to trust Jesus. So what is the word spoken by angels? Now, of course, we know that angels are God's agents. And this is a reference then to the law that was given by Moses. As I said, the writer doesn't prove this point. It would be acknowledged by any Jew. It was used as evidence of the Jews having let it slip by Stephen in Acts, the 7th chapter, where he calls that law that was given at Sinai the word spoken through angels. Can I get somebody to read, when you get a chance, read his whole defense. It goes from Acts 7 at verse 22 all the way down through verse 53. And we don't have time to read all of it. It's a history that you're mostly familiar with. But can somebody read verses 37 through 38? I think somebody was trying to read it and you may be muted.
I can try and read it.
Okay.
All right. This is the Moses who said to the sons of Israel, God shall raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel who was speaking to him on Mount Sinai and who was with our fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to you.
So it's this Moses received living oracles from angels. Can I get somebody to read verse 53?
Who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it.
Okay. So what's the point of verse 53?
Well, they received it, but they didn't keep it.
Okay. So he doesn't try to prove that it came from angels. He just says, you know it came from angels, and you didn't keep it. Moses testified himself to the angelic influence in the giving of his law. Look at Deuteronomy 33. Can I get somebody to read verses 1 and 2?
Now this is the blessing for Moses, the man of God, blessed the sons of Israel before his death. And he said, the Lord came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. At his right hand was flashing lightning for them.
Okay. When the Septuagint translators looked at this passage, they added the phrase, at his right were angels with him. So this is Moses saying, when I got the law, this is what happened. There's an oblique reference to this in Psalm 68 at verse 17, but it's kind of vague. It's something that, of course, the Jews would have been familiar with, but we'll just skip that, and you can look at that on your own. But it's a point that is made by the Apostle Paul in Galatians 3 at verse 19. Can somebody read that for us?
I have it. What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator.
Okay. So when he says that the word spoken through angels was steadfast, that's a reference to the Old Testament. It's a reference to the law that was given by Moses. And it was, in fact, given by God. And we can also say that every time people drifted away from it or didn't give heed to it, it resulted in some sure consequences. It came from God, and it was enforced, I think, by God. So he uses two terms here to talk about people who drift away or don't give heed. He uses the word transgression. Now this transgression has to do with a deliberate act. In Numbers 15, verses 32 through 36, it talks about the man who knew that God said, don't gather manna on the Sabbath, but he did anyway. It's a deliberate act to ignore what God said. And of course, the end result was that man was to be stoned. There was condition. It was the sure consequence of transgression. Now, disobedience is from a little bit different word. And disobedience refers to an act that results from a failure to pay attention to what the law said. One is deliberate. The other one comes from just not paying close enough attention. And Deuteronomy 17 and Deuteronomy 27 both deal with people who didn't pay attention to the instructions that were given to the priests about touching the holy things. So they didn't pay attention. And they were stoned to death as well. So transgression, disobedience, we could look anywhere in Jewish history and we would see that every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward. That was true of the Old Testament, that which was delivered by the angels. Now, here's his second conditional statement. Jesus is greater than the angels. That's part of P. Jesus is greater than the angels. That comes from chapter 1. And he has expressed his expectations. The conclusion is, you must give the more earnest heed to the things that were heard, the things that came from Jesus, lest you drift away from them. That's chapter 2 at verse 1. So he's kind of states the second conditional statement before he gives us the first conditional statement. So we just put things in a little bit different order here. This is the second conditional statement. The implication from this is that these expectations came from God. They were, in the words that the Hebrew writer uses, first spoken by the Lord, and then they were confirmed to have been spoken by the Lord, by those who heard him. And the apostolic restatement of these expectations was confirmed by God using signs and wonders, manifold powers and gifts of the Holy Spirit. So the apostles worked miracles. It wasn't just so that the apostles could work miracles. It was a confirmation that what they were saying, that Jesus had told them, was true. They were saying, Jesus said, do this. And they didn't say that on their own. They didn't, the apostles never laid down the law and said, you have to do this. The apostles always said, Jesus said, this is what you must do. And if you're interested, you can spend some time looking at how the apostle qualifies some of what he says in 1 Corinthians 7. He says, this is just my advice. This didn't come from the Lord, but there are things that came from the Lord. You have to do what the Lord said. You might want to do it, but you have to do what the Lord said. And the conclusion that you have to draw from this is that if you drift away, if you don't give more earnest heed, this, because it came from the Lord who is greater than the angels, this will result in surer consequences. Now, I found it really interesting. This is a statement that Gareth Rees makes in his commentary on Hebrews, And he talks about the tense of the verb to neglect. I'm not enough of a linguist to know all that there is to know about tenses and that kind of thing as it relates to verbs. But I know I can tell you it is in the aorist tense. And what that means is that when he talks about neglecting, he's talking about a completed action or a finished act. And Gareth concludes, it does not say that one sin causes a man to be lost. In the light of the rest of Hebrews, it does say that one who quits Jesus finally and completely will be lost. If the state of mankind was such that only the Son of God could save them, then what hope can there be for any who neglect the salvation that he offers? Then you see how this kind of fits with what we discussed when we were looking at the book of Romans. You have to listen to Jesus. He's greater than the angels. And mom, this is, I'm putting it into the words that a Jewish boy who is converted might say to his Jewish mother at dinner when she says, yeah, but you're neglecting the word of God. It came from God. And he says, yeah, you're right, mom. It did come from God. But this came from a greater than the angels. So he's not saying the Old Testament, that the old Mosaic law didn't come from God. That's not even considered here. In fact, he acknowledges that it came from God. Came through the angels. But now you have to understand Jesus' expectations came from God. And they came through Jesus, who is greater than the angels. Any questions at this point before we go on to the argument that his mom might make back to him?
No, though.
Questions?
Go on.
Feel free to ask questions, make comments. I realize that I've kind of reorganized those first four verses so that it would be clear what his conditional statements were.
Okay, you did a good job. Go on. Go, go, go.
Okay. Now, mom is going to argue your conclusion doesn't necessarily follow because the P statement is not true. Jesus is not greater than the angels. If P, then Q means that Q must be true, and this is an important phrase, whenever P is true. If P is not true, then Q isn't true. Well, it could be true, but it's not necessarily true. So mom is going to argue, but Jesus was a man. And because P is not true, that he is not superior to the angels because he was a man, therefore, we don't need to give heed to his words. Now, the question that you have to ask yourself is, does Jesus' humanity contradict P? And P says he's greater than the angels. Does Jesus' humanity mean that he is not greater than the angels? And if it means that, then you don't have to listen to him. You have to listen to the angels. Questions?
Oh, I understand what you're saying, but we know that Jesus is greater than the angels.
Yeah, we do. We know that. But he's going to give this Jewish boy the ammunition that lets him respond to his mom at the Seder table. His mom is not converted. His mom wants him to come back to Judaism.
Well, Jesus is the Son of God and sat on the right hand of God, and he is deity. And when he came in the human form, it was because that they had a plan that he would come to the earth and be crucified, and then he would die and be raised again. So it hinges on that. He couldn't do that if he was a human being. He's not. He's in human form, but he's deity.
Okay, but he was a man.
Yeah, he was a man because he was sent to be crucified and die for us.
Right. Okay. I agree. You're just skipping ahead a little bit.
Oh, I always do that. Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Even though he was a man, he set aside part of his godhood. He didn't set aside all of his godhood, I don't think. And so he was always God. I and the Father are one. So he was always God, even though he was a man. But he took on the form of a man. So it's not exactly that he wasn't born of two human parents. He was born of God and of man.
Okay. But he, you know, this... What the apostle or what the writer of Hebrews is willing to accept is that Jesus was a man. Mom is true. Mom is right. Jesus was a man. The question is, does that mean that he's less than the angels? Okay. So here is the way that he answers that. This is verses 5-9. He says, "For not unto the angels did he subject the world to come, whereof we speak. One hath somewhere testified, saying, What is man that thou art mindful of him? Or the son of man that thou visitest him? Thou madest him a little lower than the angels. Thou crownest him with glory and honor, and didst set him over the work of thy hands. Thou didst put all things in subjection under his feet. For in that he subjected all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him, a subject to him. But now we see not yet all things subject to him. We behold him who hath been made a little lower than the angels, which is Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he should taste death for every man." But at this point, when Hebrews is written and when we live, Jesus is not in the position, obviously, or observably, of being greater than the angels. Now let me see if I can explain this. Jesus remained superior to the angels since his humanity was only temporary. Jesus did, in reality, aside his position become a man.
Raise that up, and there's a...
That's chapter 2 at verse 7. First part of verse 7. Jesus really did lay aside his position as being superior to the angels and become a man. Now, becoming a man is still an honorable position. Man is over the works of God's hands. That comes from creation. God said that man was to subdue the earth and have control over it. So, man is an important position, but man is still not greater than the angels. As a man, Jesus is not superior to the angels. And Jesus still functions as a man. He has been raised. He is with God. But at this point, God has not subjected the world to come to Jesus, and that's the position that we talk about. Jesus' humanity allowed him to taste death and defeat death. Now, there will come a time when Jesus will be restored to his position, the position that he rightfully holds, but it's not yet. Jesus' suffering doesn't prove that he's not greater than the angels. That's the Jewish argument number two. Jesus suffered. Jesus died. Angels don't die. So Jesus is less than the angels. You're right. Everything about that is true, except for the last part. That doesn't mean that Jesus is not superior to the angels. That's Hebrews 2, verses 10 through 18. So let's look at that. It became him, and that's Jesus, for whom are all things and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he that sanctifieth and they that are sanctified are all of one. For which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the congregation I will sing thy praise. Again, he said, I will put my trust in him. Again, behold, I am the children whom God hath given me. Since then the children are sharers in flesh and blood, he also himself in like manner partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For verily not to angels does he give help, but he gives help to the seed of Abraham. Wherefore it behooved him, in all things to be made like unto his brethren, that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that he himself hath suffered being tempted, he is also able to succor them that are tempted. Now, we tend to take little pieces of those statements and say Jesus is able to succor them that are tempted. Yes, that's right. But that misses the whole point. Jesus' suffering was for the purpose of freeing man from death. And in his suffering, he shows that he's greater than the angels. It's not that his suffering doesn't mean he's less. His suffering means that he's more. Mom, you're wrong. P is true. So is Q. Jesus did die. He didn't just pass out on the cross. The man Jesus died. Not that he was conquered by death, but he died so he could destroy death. He can't reign until, or he reigns now in a sense, but his last enemy hasn't been destroyed yet. First Corinthians 15 talks about when that last enemy is destroyed. It's at the resurrection of all men. So Jesus did die. He wasn't conquered by death. When he died, he destroyed death. Now, here's the interesting part. He didn't do this to help angels. Why? Because they were never held captive to death. Angels don't die. They were never conceived as being captive to death. They don't sin. They're the messengers of God. They don't need the help. The seed of Abraham needed the help, and I think that's a kind of thinly veiled dig at the Jewish belief that they were superior to everybody else. The Jews were captive to death. Angels weren't. Jews were. No angel ever freed man from death as a propitiation for the sins of the people. They didn't do that. Jesus' suffering was for the purpose of freeing man from death. No angel ever became a man so that he could succor those that are tempted. Jesus did. That's his greatness. That's how he's greater than the angels. Having destroyed death, Jesus remains superior to the angels when all men are raised. Now, he hasn't done that yet. That's why he says, we see Jesus. He's not back in his position yet. And God never said to any of the angels, I will make the entire world subject to you. Everything in this world that you see and things you don't see, Death hasn't been destroyed yet. So that's why the Jewish mom could say, yeah, but he died. It's because he hasn't taken his position yet. But God promised it to him. So, here's his argument. If P, then Q. If the word came from Jesus and he expressed his expectations, then you have to give the more earnest heed to the things which we've heard. It's more important to listen carefully to God than it is to listen to the angels. It was important to listen to angels, but it's more important to listen to God. So that's his point. Any questions at this point? Comments.
That kind of just muddies the water for me, but I guess I'm different. I understand what you're saying, but it's just, I thought I put it more clearly because Jesus is God, so is Holy Spirit God, and God the Father is God. They're all deity. And when he came as a man, he still held his deity, but he had a purpose to serve, and that's what he did. And then he now sits on the right hand of God. So it makes it more complicated to me to just do that, but I'm kind of a simple-minded person, and I just like to get right to the point. So, but that's just me.
Other comments? Sorry, I made it less clear. It wasn't my effort. It wasn't my intention.
Well, you didn't do badly. I'm not saying that because I did understand what you were saying. It just was harder to understand. But I did understand what you said.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I don't know. I guess as a kid, I always never understood why the Jewish people didn't believe in Jesus. And I think this just kind of sums it up, that they're still following the Old Testament and they're picking and choosing what they want to read in the New Testament as far as believing what Jesus has done for us. And I just think you really have to know your Bible if you're going to speak to any of those people so that you can try to get them to understand, but they're so set in their ways. It boggles my mind that they just don't get the picture.
Well,
that made any sense.
I have not been able to convince several Jews that I have had extensive conversations with that this is the case. But every Jew that I've talked to finished the conversation by saying, well, you make me think.
Well, we have to remember that what is being presented here is this writer's argument to Jewish people. And so he's using some basic truths from the Old Testament, from what they know. And he's also stating basic truths that they know is that they have kind of cherry-picked this along the way. But they have their traditions that are rooted in what God said and the law that God gave them. And I think that they had a tendency, much like we do as Christians, we have a tendency to say, well, that's what I know. I have this confidence in that. And I'm not going to be challenged to think anything differently because this is what I know. Well, what they knew was what God had told them. So this is just, and I think it was the Apostle Paul. I know you don't agree with that necessarily, Dean, but the writer of Hebrews is writing to these Hebrew people and saying, here are the truths that you know. Here's what you know. And you can drive a stake right there. Yes, you know that. But now it's time to build on that. So this is just an analysis of his argument. You know, we have the advantage of kind of hindsight where we've got the scriptures, we have the New Testament, so we have the whole story. But they didn't have the whole story, or they did, but they didn't know that they had the whole story. And so the author here is writing this to give them the whole story, the rest of the story that they didn't understand. So that's the way I'm understanding your analysis. I don't know. Yeah. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the difficulty that we have understanding the Jewish position is that for the most part, we didn't grow up as Jews. We don't know that Jewish tradition.
Correct. And that's why this is so specifically written to Jews. So we have to sort of take ourselves out of we have to look at the primary audience. We're the secondary audience, the readers, all these generations later. But the primary audience that he's writing to, what were these Jews who he was trying to show that, yeah, you've got something good there, but that's not all there is to the story. There's more to this story.
Right.
Well, and look how hard it is to get people to believe the truth today. You know, I mean, I know we're not Jewish, but, and they had God, but we have God too. And so we can be just as stubborn as they can. Or unbelieving, yeah. Or disobedient.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, Eileen, that we can be just as stubborn as they were, sometimes even more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for bearing with me this evening. I realized that was that's a kind of a lot of technical logic argument type information. But that's the what I think is so masterful about the book of Hebrews. It is a brilliantly constructed argument, just like Romans is a brilliantly constructed argument. And to be honest, most of the time, I don't think that technically. But for the person who is willing to think that technically, it's beautiful. You don't want to think.
And I think that's why
go ahead.
I was going to say that's why I think that Paul wrote it, because of the technical nature, that high level nature of the writing. And he was a Jew. He knew this stuff backwards and forwards. He knew the way they thought. But he was really primarily sent to the Gentiles, which I find very fascinating. But I think that this is him writing in that Jewish style, that technical, and he's going to lay out a technical argument for Jesus that I think that he knows will resonate with that primary audience. Because he is one. He, and highly intellectual and highly educated. And so those arguments are the reason I think that it was written by Paul. And if it wasn't, it was probably written by one of his very, very close associates.
Well, I agree with you, I think this is just pointing out the wonder of the way that this is written. Okay, we've run out of time. We got all the way through the second chapter. I will report to Ted tomorrow that we made it through the second chapter. And I frankly am a little surprised that I was able to do that.